Today on Off Mic, running a small business these days takes more than luck. It takes positive thinking. We talk to one local caterer that offers lunch with a side of inspiration. And low-income Northwest Indiana parents of sick children can seek medical treatment closer to home. And what's with this feud between Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb and lawmakers that's landed them in court and making art out of junk? All this on Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Michael Puente. When low-income parents from Northwest Indiana need to find top-notch care for their child who may be suffering from cancer or other illnesses, oftentimes they have to travel 2 to 3 hours away to hospitals in Indianapolis. Why? That's because the pediatric hospitals in Chicago won't take those children, not because they don't want to, but because Indiana won't reimburse them at the same Medicaid rate as Indiana hospitals. That's about to change. A bill that passed the State House was signed by Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb into law. Indiana State Representative Hal Slager sponsored the bill and joins us to talk about it. Representative Slager, this is a bill that's been in the long time coming, correct?
I started looking into this back in 2013 and trying to figure out what the problems were, and they were all kinds of mechanical issues as it related to reimbursement, but ultimately, in addition to that, it had to do with reimbursement for out-of-state Medicaid patients, and this is going to have such a dramatic impact on so many families, not just in Northwest Indiana, but especially in Northwest Indiana, but also the Louisville and Cincinnati markets are positively impacted as well, and it just makes Indiana one more arrow in the quiver of being a great place to live.
Yeah, I'm not. I just want to make sure I categorize it the right way. It's now going to allow for out-of-state pediatric hospitals to be reimbursed close to the in-state Medicaid rate or the same.
It is. We need to be careful when we're talking about rates. It will be reimbursement close to what our in-state hospitals get reimbursed. The funding mechanisms for Medicaid are very complicated, and rate is just one aspect of it.
I see.
So what we've done, we found a way to get this done in such a way that the amount of reimbursement may not be exactly the same, but it'll be similar.
I see. And this is just going to allow, because I know in some of the testimony I heard back in February when there was a hearing, a number of hospitals, I hope I'm categorizing this right, in Chicago, for example, would have to almost refuse to treat a child because of the rate was so low. Now that's going to open up treatment options closer to home for children who need it.
Sure. Well, it's... In Illinois, they were particularly generous with certain services, particularly pediatric. They recognized pediatrics as a real specialty. And so they have certain add-ons and multipliers that really ramped it up that made the disparity really huge between Indiana and Illinois. So when it came to ongoing long-term treatment, that's when those hospitals in Illinois didn't want to take those on for when it involved Medicaid reimbursement. Of course, emergencies, that's part of their charter. They have to take the emergencies and always have. But in this case, now that they have a much better expectation of covering their costs, I think we're going to see even more services offered by those hospitals right in Northwest Indiana. We're starting to see some of those partnerships develop now. But I see this as somewhat of an economic development issue where it's going to mean jobs and employment for more Hoosiers right here close to home.
Representative Slager, another big issue that came up this week was Governor Eric Holcomb suing legislators over a bill that would allow the General Assembly to call itself into an emergency session. This stems from all the executive orders Holcomb has signed and continues to sign related to the pandemic. Holcomb vetoed the bill, but the legislators overrode it. Now it's going to court. Holcomb says it's because it's unconstitutional, in his view, that only he can call a special session. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I was unaware that he'd actually filed suit. So that's news to me. And that's fine if you want to take it, the lawsuit, and get it straightened out now before an emergency happens. I want to go on record. I think Governor Holcomb's done a terrific job. And had we been able to call ourselves back in the session, I don't think we would have, and I don't think we would have changed the thing. This really wasn't a statement, in my opinion, was not a statement about the governor and his performance, but a reality that there are neighboring states where the governors have really gone to an extreme, and we needed some way for the people to be able to weigh in after a certain amount of time. And so rather than trying to trim down the executive orders and authority, because it's necessary, we just run into situations where somebody's got to make a decision, they got to make a decision now, and there's not time to debate it. And so rather than affecting that, just giving ourselves an option to come back might change the flavor of all of that. It may never come to pass. It may never be needed again. But that's what it was. It was to give ourselves that opportunity in the future if we wanted to pursue it. And of course, the bar has to be pretty high there where all the caucuses of the legislature agreed to do that. So it was not certain by any means a willy-nilly decision. And I figured that this would not be an issue unless it was ever invoked. So we'll see what happens.
Representative Hal Slager is a Republican from Schererville. Representative Slager, thank you so much for joining us here today on Off Mic.
All right.
Take care. Bye-bye. Sure. And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic. I'm Michael Puente. Well, we were just talking to Indiana State Representative Hal Slager of Schererville about this lawsuit that Governor Eric Holcomb filed against lawmakers this week. Governor Holcomb says the state's constitution only gives him the right to call for a special session. We're not in Illinois where they have special sessions all the time. This is Indiana. So Holcomb says he has a duty to uphold the state's constitution and has filed a lawsuit. This has to do with Holcomb's executive orders for mask mandates and limited indoor dining and all the rest and all the other restrictions. His fellow Republican lawmakers say he went too far. Joining me to talk about this lawsuit is Andrew Downs, director of the Michael Downs Center for Politics at Purdue University Fort Wayne, which is named after his father. So, Andrew, how significant is this lawsuit filed by the governor? I guess it was expected.
It very much was expected. When the governor vetoed the bill, he pretty much said, I believe that this is unconstitutional. Clearly, the legislature disagreed with him. Everybody who watches Indiana politics knew this was coming because it's the court that's going to have to settle this. So this is the first step in that process.
And is there any indication as to how successful his lawsuit might be? I mean, does he have a valid point that the even though the legislation says emergency session, maybe they're splitting hairs with emergency or special, in looking at the lawsuit, what chances do you give him to be successful?
Well, when you look at the language in the Constitution, it's pretty clear when the session begins and ends in terms of regular sessions. It gives the governor power for special sessions. It is silent on anything called an emergency session. Clearly, that's what the General Assembly is hanging its hat on. But at the same time, somebody could make an argument that the Constitution already recognizes all the kinds of sessions that could exist, which means that an emergency session would be unconstitutional. What I think will be interesting is that Indiana's courts quite often function under the assumption that legislation is constitutional unless proven otherwise. So in other words, the burden really may end up falling more on the governor to prove it's unconstitutional than for the legislature to prove that it is constitutional.
How often do we see governors in the past, governors suing the state lawmakers?
Yeah, this does not happen very often. I mean, this is not unprecedented, but it doesn't happen very often. I would have to go back and look at the filings, but I can't think of this. I can't think of another example of this in the recent past. Now, I will say part of what makes this interesting is that this is really a question about the separation of powers as well. And so it clearly starts out as a constitutional question, whereas other things may start out as a legitimate disagreement between parties that can be resolved before it gets up to the Supreme Court level. But this just seems to be on a course for the Supreme Court.
I see. And, you know, and some of the things that the lawmakers were kind of critical of, the way Holcomb handled the pandemic last year, some of the emergency orders, they didn't seem to really, although there was some hemming and hawing during the session, they didn't seem to really pass anything in relation to any of those. Maybe a couple of things here and there, but they didn't seem like they didn't certainly stop the emergency mandate right now.
Right, and part of what they've managed to do there is demonstrate that this is not some sort of a power they're going to use too loosely. In other words, if they had decided they were trying to just take over everything, they would have passed a bunch of legislation right now. As it is, it looks like they went at things rather cautiously. Of course, it helps that we're sort of on the downside of the pandemic, and so things were getting loosened up anyway, and there would have been almost no reason for them to do anything to loosen them up faster, except for those who were adamantly opposed to what had been happening in terms of masks. So in some respects, this makes their point that this is not a power they're going to use frivolously. It's one they will use seriously and only when it's necessary.
Do you think they have a point in that, okay, there is an emergency, but now it's gone on months, almost, you know, past a year? Do they have a point that, you know, yes, it's an emergency, Governor, but you just can't have this wide mandate to do whatever you want?
There is a point, and I think that a lot of people would agree that the emergency legislation or the emergency powers that are put into state law clearly were thinking about things like tornadoes and floods, things of, we'll call them, short duration. I don't think too many people were thinking about something that would last for over a year. At the same time, if something lasts that long, the legislature will be back in session. In fact, we don't really go an entire year without them being in session. They're either done in the middle of March or at the end of April, and they come back into session again in January. So we never go really a full 12 months without them being able to get into session in the typical fashion and pass legislation that would address the issues that they believe need to be addressed. So, you know, this is kind of a difficult situation because we are looking at something that probably, we hope, we won't see again in our lifetime. You know, it's maybe a once-in-a-century kind of thing. I think that they want to be cautious about passing legislation that empowers them for a single incident, in other words, a solution going in search of a problem or creating a power that could be manipulated or misused at a later date. I think that's something that they need to be concerned about as well. And I do think that come, you know, maybe 5, 10, 20 years from now, there will be some legislators and, for that matter, some folks in local government who regret the attempts to usurp the power of the governor or of a board of health or a health commissioner because they're going to get pressured to use that in a way that they don't believe is necessary. And if it wasn't on the books, then that wouldn't be the case. Now, that's a different piece of legislation, obviously, but the issues do sort of come together in this question about the power of the legislature, the power of elected officials.
And you definitely don't see, like last time we talked about this, a sort of similar lawsuit where the governor, I guess, they worked hand in hand to try to change the state constitution to allow, I believe, forgot what it was for. But
tax caps.
Right.
Yeah.
Where in this regard, it doesn't look like the governor wants to give up that power of being able to, or at least not granting the legislature emergency session powers.
Yeah, I was a little surprised that the legislature and the governor were not able to find some sort of a compromise here, because we know they've been able to do that in the past. They did that with the tax caps. They passed legislation that I think could have been argued as unconstitutional, but they did it and also began amending the Constitution at the same time. Given that the pandemic seems to be, on the backside, or we're on the backside of the pandemic, you would think that they would have been able to have a conversation about what to do the next time there's a pandemic and actually think about amending the Constitution so that the legislature would have some sort of emergency session powers. But because they weren't able to do that, this legislation simply got passed. Maybe there were some people concerned that there would be a need for a legislature to call itself into session before we could get through our constitutional amendment process, which is not a short process.
And that was Andrew Downs, director of the Michael Downs Center for Politics at Purdue University, Fort Wayne. And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic. I'm Michael Puente. Did you know there's a semiconductor shortage in the United States and the world? Semiconductors are in all of our electronics. If you're an auto worker, you know there's a shortage, because this shortage has forced the Ford plant on Chicago's far south side in Hegewisch, where many Northwest Indiana folks work, to temporarily halt production. They suspended operations earlier this month and may not get back to work until mid-May. So what's behind this shortage? Joining me to talk about that is John Del Sassi, computer engineering professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Well, John, no pun intended, what is driving this shortage of semiconductors?
You know, it's been driven by a lot of factors. Yeah, I mean, I think that one, it could have been anticipated that a major perturbation like, again, COVID caused, was going to create problems. Especially with, a lot of the semiconductor manufacturing moving out of the U.S. over the last, handful of decades.
So do most of these semiconductors, they come from overseas?
A lot of them do. I mean, you have manufacturers like Samsung, they're in Korea, TSMC, which is one of the major manufacturers of semiconductors, they're in Taiwan. In North America, we've got Micron, but they're largely focused more on, memory-type devices and things.
Are you surprised that it's gotten to the point where manufacturers, auto manufacturers in the U.S., have had to sort of just shut down for a couple of weeks to... because of the delay in getting some more semiconductors?
Sure. I mean, it's a critical part of their manufacturing process. So anytime any component has a shortage like that, it's going to cause a production disruption. Of course, with semiconductors, where the lead times are very long and there's risk associated with having over inventory, the automotive supply chain manufacturer, the supply chain managers are going to potentially be conservative when something like this hits. And then that's going to come back to cause a problem in getting back in the queue in some of these manufacturers, IC manufacturers.
Right. You know what, too? And we see it in auto manufacturers, but are there other industries that rely on semiconductors where they may have to scale back production because of a lack of having these devices?
Sure. I mean, well, semiconductors are pervasive. I mean, almost every device that we have or interact with uses semiconductors that come from a handful of manufacturers. I think it also in part the COVID crisis has led to an increase in demand for things like smartphones and devices used for people working out of the home, you know, remote education. The demand in all those areas actually has taken some of that capacity dedicated towards automotive to satisfy telecommunications needs and things, which has exacerbated the problem. You know, you have other people taking the capacity that was released by the automotive manufacturers, and again, certainly a wide number of industries utilize the types of electronics that you see in automotive applications.
All right, and do you see a sort of solution to this, or do you see any time soon where the number of semiconductors where this problem gets fixed, or is it just going to get worse?
Well, it's part of it is the problem associated with the large cost of infrastructure in a semiconductor fabrication facility. So it costs billions of dollars to build a semiconductor fab. And the amount of time that it takes to build capacity also is not a short-term problem. The industry itself does tend to have a cyclical nature to it. You know, so there's periods where you have greater demand followed by lesser demand. I think in the things that I've seen, the expectation is that the semiconductor manufacturing industry is going to be pushing its capacity limits for some time as it responds not only to the automotive demand, but other demand areas. The risk associated with building a fab is also part of the problem. I mean, when you're going to make $1 billion-plus investment, you need to make sure that once you do that, that there'll be a market for the products coming out of there. Because, you know, again, as you can imagine, in a fab that costs that much money, idle time is very expensive. So companies are going to be conservative in building capacity. In fact, I think I saw a quote from someone saying that de-risking this, you know, by having effectively the government step in or governments step in, to say we're going to cover the cost of this infrastructure build, you know, if it doesn't lead to serving market demand, is something that has been recommended. But again, that presents its own problems. You know, other countries do have some level of government subsidy in the creation of this infrastructure. So it's a challenging problem. My heart goes out to all those people who are affected by this, and you know, the people who are building these cars who are being affected by this. I mean, that's a tragedy.
And that was John Del Sassy, computer engineering professor at U of I in Urbana-Champaign. And we'll be back with more Offline. Welcome to Off Mic with me, Michael Puente. It's tough to run a business these days. COVID has knocked so many small businesses out of business. So what does it take? For some, just a positive outlook on life. Off Mic student intern producer Stephanie Daniels sat down with Anthony Waller, owner of a Chicago-based catering business that offers lunch with the side of inspiration.
My name is Anthony Waller. I am the president of Catering Out the Box. It's not catering out of the box. So many people make that mistake. It's ebonically correct, catering out the box. Been in business for 18 years now. We're a full-service caterer throughout the Chicagoland, Northwest Indiana, Wisconsin border. We do everything from box lunches, continental breakfasts, hors d'oeuvres, appetizers, full-service event weddings, you name it, anything involved around food, we have the capacity to do.
Gotcha. And how did you start your business? What was the beginning for you? I know a lot of people are familiar with catering, but it is something that isn't thought of as far as, well, let me go grab lunch versus let me go grab lunch for the company. What got your business started?
So I did it kind of in reverse. My background prior to starting the company, I was in broadline distribution. I worked for a company called the John Sexton Company, which today is U.S. Food Service. Mm. And I had the opportunity of servicing a number of restaurateurs, caterers, basically people within the food service hospitality industry. So I got to see as far as the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I always had a passion for food, and catering just kind of fell into my lap. After I left U.S. Food Service, I did some brokerage work for a company called Sara Lee, and did that for about 2.5 years. Didn't have the same love for brokerage work as I did for broadline distribution, and I just saw a niche in terms of being able to have a catering company that would service primarily the pharmaceutical market.
Okay. And how has your business been during COVID? What changes have you had to make? What's been different for you?
Well, obviously, every business has been impacted by COVID. We were in a little bit of a good situation in the fact that we're not a restaurant. As a caterer, we go to the client rather than the client coming to us. Mm-hmm. So the fact that we do box meals, obviously that in of itself served the first responders, it served hospital workers, it served a number of venues, and the fact that the meal itself was COVID safe. Again, we were impacted in the fact that the business that we had was not as plentiful because most of our clientele was geared towards academia and hospital-based business. So the knowledge in terms of various hospital workers knowing what we did really kind of catapulted us in terms of the overall COVID and the pandemic of being able to go out there and say, look, you know what? This is our go-to when it comes to making sure that our first responders are fed.
Yes, I know that's very important because I worked in a hospital myself, and when it came time to do lunches or events, we found it hard to find someone that could cater to us, you know, as far as like the box lunches and following the COVID protocols, which was something that changed, which we didn't really expect to change. But like you said, once it happened, it was there. What makes your company stick out besides another catering company?
Well, we're consistent in what we do. Once you establish a foundation, it's easy to build upon a solid foundation. And the foundation in which has been started upon the company based upon our box lunches, based on the quality, based on the consistency, based on just some of the other little details that we offer within each box, that really kind of sets us apart from the competitor. For example, we put an inspirational phrase in each box. If you're looking for a specific, let's say a specific theme, if you were to hire us and say, look, you know what, we're looking for a St. Patrick's Day theme or we're looking for a Valentine's Day theme, we would put specific quotes in there that would more or less mirror that theme. So given the whole pandemic, no, we didn't have pandemic quotes, mm-hmm. but the fact that you had a quotation in each box, oftentimes people would look forward just to see what that quotation would say. The sandwiches in them themselves, the fact that everything is made fresh. We don't use any frozen product. We're not outsourcing anything outside of as far as the bread that we receive in on a daily basis. Everything else we make fresh in-house. And again, I think that really makes a difference in the fact that people appreciate it and the fact that we're reliable when it comes as far as the delivery. If you tell us that delivery needs to be there at 11:45, typically that delivery is going to be there between 11:30 and 11:35. So we run ahead of schedule very, very rarely. And again, you can look at our online reviews. If nothing else, we get dinged for being a little bit too far ahead of schedule versus being late.
Okay. And then you guys have been in business for 18 years, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And what changes has your company gone through? Like, what growth have you made in those 18 years?
Three moves. I literally started out of my garage. Don't suggest that from anyone, especially in the food service arena, but you know, you got to start somewhere, and some of the bigger organizations started out the same way. From there, we pivoted and moved to 64th and Cottage Grove. Second move was to 2443 West 16th Street, right behind Center Space. And now we're in a 12,000 square foot state of the art facility at 4300 West Lake.
Yeah, and I bet that feels great.
It really does. I mean, it's like heaven right now. We have space upon space, and really excited right now with colleagues and friends that are looking to do some special things as far as internal build-out and external build-out. So there's a lot of excitement.
Thank you. What kind of advice would you give? Like you said, you were an entrepreneur yourself. What kind of advice would you give to those other entrepreneurs out there that are thinking about starting a business or they have the love for food?
Any entrepreneur, you have to love what you do. You know, the old Japanese proverb, if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life. I mean, I work 8 days a week. And even during this pandemic, there has not been a day outside of, you know, getting hurt and actually... Just prior to my move, I literally fell down 5 stairs and broke a rib and still made it into the shop that same day, even with a broken rib, only to realize that I couldn't move when I got out of my truck. But it's a matter of perseverance, and it's a matter of loving what you do and understanding in terms of that your love is not so much for the financial gain as it is just in the fact that you love your industry, you love as far as your career. And I think that really kind of domino effects into the workers that you have and the people that are around you and just the vibe that you give off.
I believe I might have had one of your meals at
New Employee Orientation.
McAllister's Deli. They brought us in these box lunches and they had the inspirational quote in it, and that's what stuck out to me, because okay. It was just like a little tad bit that you didn't expect, but
right.
It was in there, and I'm like a dork for those kind of things, so when I okay. saw it, I was like, wait a minute, you know, it's kind of like a fortune cookie,
yep.
but of catering. So
exactly.
That was a great piece, and I'm pretty sure you've not, I haven't seen any other company.
I know of no other caterer that does that.
Yeah.
I mean, it costs us, you know, 3 cents for each quote that we put in each box. So I mean, I think, you know, the 3 cents that I put in there, the return on the investment has been significant, because I have to say at least 20% of our clientele has found us, because on one side there's the marketing piece, mm-hmm. our Facebook, our email along with our website, and then on the other side is the quote.
Yeah.
So, you know, when people look at that, you know, I have people that to this day, if they've had multiple boxes, they're like, you know what? I've got 20 quotes here and none of them are the same.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's good, because I've got 10,000 quotes in my database. If you got 2 quotes that are the same, something's wrong.
Yeah. Who comes up with your quotes?
So some of the quotes come up just based on I'm driving down the road and I see a road sign that's kind of quirky or interesting quote. I'll jot it down or I'll take a picture of it. In other quotes, I might see from social media. I may see just in print. And in other quotes, there are certain books that have a series of quotations based upon various genres. So it's a culmination of all of the above.
Gotcha. Yeah, and those quotes sometimes can mean a lot to people. It could be like you're having a tough day and, you know, you get your lunch break, like, okay, let me reset the day. And then you open that up and that quote just might be the quote that is the turning point to your day. So on top of like the great meal, you get that quote that's like, all right, we've turned the day around. Like, this makes a difference. So
the idea is to always give something that's going to be positive and inspirational and in some cases thought-provoking, never negative.
Yeah. You have a very positive energy that's like flowing from you. Where does this come from that you like put into your business? Where do you generate this positivity from?
I've got to give credit to my parents. Fortunately, they're still around. My dad is 96. My mom is 88. And they've always instilled just, you know, be who you are, stand up. My dad, you know, he's a gentle giant, 6'3", and has always been very positive. My mom, you know, positive reinforcement. And the fact that one of my old mentors stated early on when I first got into corporate America, we have eyes in the front of our head, not in the back of our head. So you always have to continue to look forward.
That's
so
great.
With that, you know, from that perspective, it's important just to continue to think positive.
Our thanks to Anthony Waller, owner of Out the Box Catering, speaking with Off Mic producer intern Stephanie Daniels. And we'll be back with more Off Mic. Welcome back to Off Mic. I'm Michael Puente. What's that saying? One person's junk is another person's treasure. That could apply to an event this weekend in Gary's Miller Beach section. Hosted by the Miller Beach Arts and Creative District, Art from Excess 2 will happen at 6 on Saturday evening at the Marshall J. Gardner Center for the Arts. It will feature art made from discarded metals. Joining me in studio to talk about this event is Chris Topher and Meg Roman. Welcome both of you to the show.
Great to be here.
Thank you for having us, Michael.
Well, Chris, we'll start off with you. You're one of the artists. You're the artist that kind of put this thing together. What can people expect when they go to this?
Well, it's over 70 works of art. A lot of them are paintings. There's some sculpture. Some are very whimsical. For example, there's a giant tree made out of 20 years of old paint. There's a giant beaver made out of hundreds of old paint brushes. And a coffee table made out of coffee grounds. So we're talking about a wide range in a lot of paintings.
Now, are these all made by one artist, several artists, local artists? Tell me a little bit about the artists.
So I'm the primary artist. I'm a resident of Miller Beach. There is a couple other artists. Because of the pandemic, we kind of limited the scope. We did do this show 5 years ago when we had 20 artists, but right now I'm the primary one. And if you come at 6 o'clock, you're going to see a performance, which will be my entrance, which will be well worth the trip, I think.
And tell me a little bit about your background. I see from your Facebook page, you went to the Art Institute in Chicago, the School of the Art Institute. Tell us a little bit more about you.
Right. So I lived in Chicago for years. I actually run a nonprofit business that works with vacant properties. We do something called decorative board up, which is an attractive way to secure vacant buildings and helps revitalize neighborhoods that have a lot of vacant properties. And I work all over the country doing that, and I've worked a lot in Gary. In fact, if you've ever been on Broadway in Gary, you've probably seen my work. We also do a lot of local hiring and training to do this type of work. And I did go to the Graduate School of the Art Institute for painting and drawing, and moved down here because I heard it was a great community, and because of the Arts District, too, kind of drew me to the community. A great place for artists. There's a lot of them there.
And where do you find the materials for your works?
Well, a lot of times when I'm working in these vacant buildings, I find material. One example is a factory called a nut and bolt factory, which is on the east side of Gary that's been abandoned for about 50 years. And so one piece has nuts and bolts that I found in there. And tons of metal shavings. Another piece has hundreds of rusty nails from a mansion in the Catskills in New York. So it's a wide range.
Now, would you consider this stuff, it's discarded, would you consider it, before it becomes a piece of yours, would it be considered junk?
A lot of it would be. In fact, my partner thinks it's...
it's still maybe, right?
It still is junk, but... you know, art materials are expensive, and I love the idea of turning stuff that people would throw away into something that people would actually spend money for.
Right. Now, Meg Roman, you are the executive director of the Arts and Creative District in Miller Beach, or the Miller Beach Arts and Creative District. Let me ask you this. Is this the first sort of public event for a while? Because I know organizations have had to shut down because of COVID-19. Is this sort of almost a coming out party?
Well, we are very fortunate. We have a large 6,000 square foot former drugstore that is very amenable to social distancing. And we did have to close for about 3 months, but we were able to kind of redirect how we did some of our exhibits. So other than the 3 months when we were mandated to be closed, mm-hmm. we've been open. We have large picture windows, so we had artists in residence inside, but people could view them from the sidewalks outside. We did an outside exhibit, and we've had, will be our third opening reception in 2021. And again, I think we're blessed because of the large space. We do still require masks. We have hand sanitizer. We clean more often than we used to. So we're kind of trying to feel like we're back to normal, but with some restrictions.
What do you think about this event, using discarded materials and or junk to create perhaps a piece of art? What's your thought on that?
I love it. In 2016, Chris, as he mentioned, created this exhibit called Art from Excess. This is Art from Excess 2. He brought together a bunch of artists from Chicago, all Chicagoland, Chicago and Northwest Indiana. I have come to purchase several pieces of art from several of those artists and have gone to their exhibits in different cities. So I love the idea of taking something that's not used or that's even a detriment to society and creating a piece of art. It's awesome.
Now, there's supposed to be, according to Chris, like 70 pieces of art there. What are some of your favorites that maybe people should keep an eye out for?
I don't know the names of the titles at the moment because there are so many pieces I can't remember. But there are a couple that are made out of steel shavings and screws and old pieces of sticks that are, you know, trees. There's a lot of landscape. There's a large green one with a little building on a hill or on a cliff. Totally eclectic. You probably haven't seen anything like it. So you need to come and see it for yourself.
And tell me a little bit about the Miller Beach Arts and Creative District. Miller Beach is almost like a city within a city, a little town in Gary, and very popular. How long have you guys been around, and how often do you have events?
We started in 2011. And the reason we even exist is because around that time, lots of businesses and restaurants and stores were closing because of the economics. And a group of volunteers got together and said, what can we do about this? We need to do something. So it was all volunteer-led until I was hired, and there's only one employee. So it's a labor of love for a lot of people. We are a nonprofit, so all our funding comes from grants or individual donations. Sometimes people think we're funded by some great magnanimous person or part of the city. We're just a little scrappy. So everybody who walks in the door and puts a couple dollars in the till, it helps out a lot. And we provide events year-round, every weekend, 52 weekends a year. And it's everything. We try to do a lot of different things. We do everything from, like, Chris's exhibit. A lot of exhibits are paintings or photography, sculptures. We do incorporate dance performances, culinary, arts, really anything. We do a graffiti festival every 2 years on Lake Street. So if anybody's familiar with the Jackson 5 that used to be on Lake Street, then by Felix Maldonado, who then created a larger one in downtown Gary, the alleys along Lake Street all have vibrant graffiti art. And we just try to do a lot of different things to appeal to a lot of different people.
Where can people find more about your group?
Our website is www.millerbeacharts.org, or you can find us on Facebook, millerbeacharts.org. We're also on Instagram. And our Facebook page is probably the best place to keep track with things.
Okay.
This event that, or this exhibit that Chris is doing, also involves a couple of events on subsequent weekends. So it'll be up from May 1st through May 30th. So 6 weekends of the year, and we love to see everybody there.
Great. And the event is tomorrow, Saturday, May 1st, 6 p.m. at the Marshall J. Gardner Center for the Arts in Miller.
Yes, 540 South Lake Street.
Great. Well, I want to thank Chris Topher, artist, and Meg Roman, executive director of the Arts and Creative District in Miller Beach. Thank you so much for being here today on Off Mic.
Thank you for having us.
You know, and I didn't want the show to end without giving a big shout out to Gary native Mia Neal for her big win at the Oscars last Sunday. Take a listen.
Oscar goes to Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Sergio Lopez Rivera, Mia Neal.
I was raised by my grandfather, James Holland. He was an original Tuskegee Airman. He represented the U.S. in the first Pan Am Games. He went to Argentina. He met Evita. He graduated from Northwestern University at a time that they did not allow blacks to stay on campus, so he stayed at the YMCA. And after all of his accomplishments, he went back to his hometown in hopes of becoming a teacher, but they did not hire blacks in the school system. So I want to say thank you to our ancestors who put the work in, were denied, but never gave up. And I also stand here as Jamaica and I break this glass ceiling with so much excitement for the future. Because I can picture black trans women standing up here, and Asian sisters, and our Latina sisters, and indigenous women. And I know that one day it won't be unusual or groundbreaking. It will just be normal. Thank you to the Academy, to Netflix, to Denzel Washington, to George C. Wolfe, to Anne Roth, to Miss Viola Davis, to Matiki Anoff, to Andrea Resnick.
Again, big congrats to Gary native Mia Neal for her big win at the Oscars for Best Makeup and Hairstyling for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. We hope to one day get me on the show, but until then, we'll have to marvel at her just like all of her fans. That's it for this episode. You can hear this show and others again at lakeshorepublicradio.org. I'd like to thank all my guests and my producers, including the fabulous Dee Donton and my student intern, producer intern, Stephanie Daniels. For me, Michael Puente, have a great weekend.